सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार।
टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू टॉक अबाउट इंडिया पाकिस्तान ट्रेड। वी हैव गॉट विद अस प्रोफेसर सलीम अली, अ यंग पाकिस्तानी, अ ग्रेजुएट ऑफ MIT एंड येल। ही हैज अ PhD फ्रॉम MIT, नाउ अ प्रोफेसर एट द यूनिवर्सिटी ऑफ डेलावेयर and a senior fellow at Columbia University, some institute there. Salim is a mashallah, you know, established Pakistani academic in the US now. And I keep reading his stuff in the newspapers and otherwise, and I can see that he's got a very promising career ahead of him. So Salim, welcome to Soch Bichar.
Ji, thank you, Nadeem sir.
Salim, India-Pakistan trade is a very contentious issue. It's something that we all worry about, talk about. What's your take on this?
Well, I think, first of all, India and Pakistan have had a historic trust deficit, of course, which could potentially be bridged by trade. But unfortunately, trade is itself used to further those kinds of skepticisms and conspiracy theories. My take at this is first that we need to focus on some of the more tangible conflicts that can be resolved. And two conflicts, particularly territorial conflicts, for me are significant in that regard. Mm. One is the Siachen Glacier conflict, and then the other one is the Sir Creek conflict. Mm. I think Kashmir is too big to resolve at this stage, so we have to take baby steps. And once we are able to build some trust through potentially the resolution of these two conflicts, I think there would be greater opportunity for trade and other aspects to come through. I don't think that trade can take place without some level of peace building on the territorial front, because at this point, the level of suspicion is just far too great for there to be anything meaningful. Even attempts at trade will get framed as in a conspiratorial light. So many of us have been working on trying to come up with very pragmatic solutions to particularly these two conflicts. Both these conflicts can be decoupled from other broader issues like Kashmir, they have been, in fact, presented both by the Indian and Pakistani military as potential areas for engagement in conflict resolution. So that's my take at it, is that these two conflicts should be our first step in a rapprochement between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm.
So it's a sequential arrangement, and that we should try and normalize the situation. My problem is that right now, Pakistan has been trying to step forward for the last many years, and India is stepping back and not coming forward. At the same time, whenever we come close, there is always some kind of a deviant group that will do something, like Bombay or like, you know, what is that, Uri or whatever. Mm. And that kind of hijacks the debate. Somehow the two countries, as you said, can't overcome the trust deficit. Is there any way to do it? Or?
No, absolutely. It's a matter of leadership. You know, if you look at different other conflicts between acrimonious neighbors, and I've studied several of them to try and understand the context, the way forward is leadership on the point of the two protagonists or antagonists, and then some form of mediation. Now, Pakistan has been willing to have some mediation historically. India has not. Yeah. Pakistan has now been somewhat lukewarm on mediation as well. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, if you look at any kind of geopolitical example of this kind of conflict, you do need some mediation. Mm-hmm. And the way forward, unfortunately, historically, has been mediation through the UN. And I don't think the UN is the appropriate body, because the Indians don't trust the UN because of the history of some of the resolutions and so on. Mm-hmm. Also, it is a very laborious mechanism for mediation. I think that what is needed is potentially there are two avenues. One is to have leadership from a country which has legitimacy on both sides and could move forward. So we had, for example, in the Ecuador and Peru conflict, which was a very long-standing conflict, similar to India-Pakistan on border disputes with armed conflict having resulted for decades. That was resolved through mediation from Brazil, a country which had legitimacy on both sides, was a major player economically in South America. Similarly, I think in the India-Pakistan case, we need a country which has that legitimacy. Recently, the Stimson Center, which is a think tank in Washington, has suggested that China could potentially play that role, because despite the saber rattling between India and China, the economic interdependence is so great that China is respected in India at some level, and certainly China has great legitimacy in Pakistan. And China is very much a regional player and sees it in their interest also that there is some level of peace building between India and Pakistan. So that has been suggested very tangibly by a respectable think tank. There are also other countries, middle powers as we call them, which could play a role. Another country which I think could play a role is Australia, because Australia has very large diasporas from both countries, especially from India, a lot of legitimacy again. And but so Salim, you
need I have
that
a problem
kind of
here. Process. I think, quite frankly, India has a vision of itself. I think let's look at it this way. There's two things that I have in mind.
Yes.
One is both countries have a vision of themselves.
Right? Yes.
And I think that vision, those visions are a big stumbling block. India has a vision that it's a large power and that it should be on par with China and with the US.
Yes.
I don't think with that kind of a vision, India is going to accept any kind of mediation because it feels that it may be subordinate to that. A subordinate to the country that's kind of mediating.
But I think the real issue is that India is living in a sort of a delusional state on this. You know, they have more abject poverty in India than all of sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. The level of comparison between India and China at the level of social mobility and inequality is not even possible for the next 30 to 40 years. So much as India sees itself in the aggregate with its tycoons and, you know, very successful businesses, it is by no means at that level, and it is in its own interest to have a much better relationship, because it will be able to reach that potential. I personally hope India does reach that potential, but it can't do it without having some kind of peace in the region. Spending $1 million a day keeping soldiers up in Siachen when you've got people living and dying on sidewalks of Calcutta makes no sense.
Salim, the point is that unfortunately such conflicts are not based on rationality.
Yes.
I think, as I said, both sides of vision. I don't just blame India. Pakistan also has a vision that's kind of keeping it away.
Yes.
I think both visions need reconciling. Pakistan's vision of an Islamic state and of, being an overarching Islamic vision that it has to spread through the world. That has also been, I think we are coming out of it. The good thing is we are coming out of it now. I think we seem to have put it behind us. But India is growing into now a vision of a kind of a traditional Hindu state or something. That's also troublesome. So I think until these two visions play out, none of those two sides will come to rationality. One, but the second point is more important. I think one of the biggest stumbling blocks in this direction has been probably the generation that I belong to, you know, the Midnight's children, who have kind of been at the helm in both countries. And as, you know, McCoon said in his Structure of Scientific Revolution, that a generation has to pass by before a paradigm changes. And I think, quite frankly, maybe the next generation might change the paradigm. But now Modi's rise to power kind of makes me wonder whether the next generation is also ready to change the paradigm or not. Somebody has to change the paradigm. But a deeper question in there is, my view, having, I mean, this is purely casual, I'm not saying it's proven or something, but casual empiricism suggests, in talking to people, etc., on both sides, we've got the entrenched colonial bureaucracy that is managing affairs. Right?
Yes.
And that entrenched colonial bureaucracy has in its roots, this conflict sort of is sitting in its roots. Unless there's domestic reform, my feeling is that maybe we will not even be able to achieve peace. Because our systems of working, our methods of doing things remain in the colonial legacy, which are so rooted in divide and rule.
Yes.
So maybe the path, and I, as I said, I'm not putting this forward as a strong thesis. This is just a weak hypothesis. Maybe the path to peace is domestic reform on both sides.
Yes.
How do you?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, the bureaucracies can be certainly an impediment, but I don't think, I mean, they can delay and make the process more inefficient. Mm. But I don't think they call the shots in terms of, you know, broader potential for peace building. My feeling is that what is really keeping this prospect for peace from reaching fruition is more so the level of misinformation, for one thing, that is constantly perpetuated on both sides about the other's intentions. There is also a level of bravado, which comes from, as you said, states don't behave rationally. It comes from a very negative kind of nationalism, which is pervasive on both sides. And it's also the failure of regional institutions such as SAARC, which could have played a positive role, but was clipped from its genesis in trying to make that possible. So I think the only way forward, really, if this is to change, is to have some kind of external pressure. And that could be, as I said, from some of the nation states that have legitimacy. The other one, which I was feeling that it has not been really capitalized on, is as much as the business community. You know, India, especially under Modi, is very responsive to businesses. Mm-hmm. And I remember about a decade ago when India and Pakistan were, you know, very much at that threshold of potentially sparking an armed conflict. It was, in fact, the business community, particularly multinationals like General Electric, where the CEO of GE made a statement that if this was to continue, he would seriously think about pulling out of India. So I think the business community can play a very constructive role. And that's why I have also suggested to groups like the World Economic Forum to play a constructive role in this kind of process. And that's where your earlier point about trade can help, because I think if these businesses, multinationals particularly, see the potential for this kind of engagement, you know, that would definitely put a positive pressure on India. And I think it'll be easier to bring Pakistan to the table overall, especially if we can resolve some of these, you know, smaller conflicts like Siachen, because that would give the military in Pakistan particularly something to, you know, hold on to and say, look, yes, we were able to, you know, resolve this, and that investment of, you know, having soldiers there for so long has paid off in a resolution. So you need some face saving for the militaries, and then one can move on to these other efforts.
No, I agree with you, and I think these things are very clear. The issue really is that, unfortunately, you know, Pakistan, as I said, has been ready now. I think Nawaz bent over backwards, as people keep talking about, trying to reach out to Modi. Modi, yeah, unfortunately, never clasped the outstretched hand that Nawaz offered him. But doesn't matter. I'm not trying to blame one side or the other. I think, yeah, it should happen. And how it will happen is a very difficult thing. But let me take it another direction. I think there's another failure. Why have the intellectuals on both sides not been able to reach out to each other? The donors have, I mean, you know, various aid groups have invested, I think, millions of dollars in arranging these track two dialogues. These track two dialogues have been track three dialogues. I don't know how many tracks have been going on for 20 years now. I think there must have been a few million dollars invested. I think that money could have been better used in alleviating poverty, right? But that money has been used to give very fine trips to people in Bangkok and, you know, Dubai and various places, and, you know, 20, 30 intellectuals from both sides come along, some editors, some this, some that. And they discuss India-Pakistan peace.
Yep.
I think that's 20 years of failure, don't you?
No, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, what we need is a track 1.5 dialogue, because track 2 dialogues are only possible in terms of their efficacy in developing, crafting potentially some solutions for tangible conflicts. So, for example, Sandia National Labs did a track 2 process between an Indian Brigadier General and a Pakistani Brigadier General at a very focused bilateral level, getting them together for 6 months, working on a way, how do we solve the Siachen conflict? And they came up with a very specific set of confidence building measures and how you could actually have a resolution of the conflict. Now, that is not going to go anywhere. These are retired people. They're living the good life. You know, they're not going to invest further in this. So if this was to be of any meaning down the road, it would need to be picked up by people who are currently in the establishment. So that's why I'm much more in favor of a track 1.5 process, similar to what was done by Asia Society on the Iran-US situation recently, where they ran a process over a few years with some existing people in governments in both countries who were involved. And that ultimately helped to pave the way for the Iran nuclear deal. I think that is the only way. The track twos, I totally agree with you. I'm also jaded with their, you know, inefficacy beyond creating some nice publications.
But let me ask you, I mean, the problem is that when people have seen this track two happening for 20 years and plush tours and, you know, all kinds of things, it has done two things. A, it has kind of, you know, tarnished mediation, because you feel if this is mediation, what's the point of mediation?
But because that is not mediation. I mean, I think that has to be clear. As someone who has studied consensus building processes, particularly environmental conflicts, you know, track two is not mediation. Track two is idea generation.
No, hang on.
Is where you actually get some party to play a facilitation role in then bridging the communication.
I appreciate that. But look at it from the point of view of the average Pakistani or Indian or whatever.
Yeah.
Then, hey, these guys are going on a pleasure tour. Right?
Yeah.
And this is what the foreign money is doing to them, right?
Yeah.
That foreign money comes in, gives them a ton of money, gives them like, you know, whatever. I mean, these are plush tours and lots of people have been going there for decades now. And yeah, they've had a nice time. But at the end, we don't even have a good newspaper article that people can read. We don't have anything that comes out. Right. And so what I'm saying is, all I'm saying, I agree with you, it's not mediation. But the point is, it makes the whole thing kind of suspicious, A. The second point is that, for God's sakes, these people who go there, I mean, you can sort of talk about track 1.5. I mean, in that case, you see, the point is Tehran or Iran had a strong vested interest in making it work, and they made it work, right? Mm-hmm. Here, neither side has a strong vested interest in making it work. But more importantly, what is it about our intellectuals on both India and Pakistan side? I think less Pakistan side. Pakistan side, I must say, Pakistani intellectuals come out far more saying that, look, let's have peace with India. But the Indian intellectuals hardly hear anything from them at all. I think the only exception is probably Arundhati Roy. Otherwise, everybody is very strongly aligned with this feeling that we have to have peace on our terms with Pakistan. Am I right or wrong?
Yes. No, I think, you know, this is the challenge of, you know, a sort of asymmetry in power and demographics and so on. Which always creates this, that the more powerful state feels that they have an upper hand, and so there's much less to negotiate with. And that is reflected in the intellectual community as well, unfortunately. That's precisely why I'm saying that without mediation and pressure, because there is existing asymmetry, it is just not going to move forward. And that kind of asymmetry can be reconciled through also making Indian intellectuals realize the enormous potential that peace could bring. I don't think they have recognized what level of benefits peace could bring to India itself. I mean, the feeling that, yes, we don't need to have peace because we're going, you know, great guns ahead, is very disingenuous, because they need to recognize the investment in their defense budget. They have to recognize the the immense cost and fracturing socially that is happening within India as a result of this perpetuation.
I don't think the Indian intellectual or the Indian leadership, except I'll tell you an incident. When I was in the Planning Commission, there was an event where myself and the Indian ambassador were speaking at a certain gathering. And I remember the Indian ambassador very clearly saying that you people in Pakistan had better realize that we don't need you. We don't need to even talk to you. Because India is now playing on a bigger landscape. India is playing with the globe, and India is a global leader. So India is going to bypass Pakistan and deal with the rest of the globe. And we really don't need to talk to you. And we really don't need peace with you. And we really don't need trade with you. Right? I think that represents, and I've heard that quite often from...
I agree. I mean, this is a delusional you know, state of bravado, which you hear all the time. And of course, no country needs each other in an existential sense. But what needs to be conveyed to them is, yes, you may not need us and we may not need you, but we could be much better off than our status quo if we did actually interact with each other. I mean, this is the same situation. I've done some work recently in Armenia and Turkey and Azerbaijan. And I'd said to the Armenians, both your neighbors you're at war with, which is ridiculous in terms of, you know, specific legacy issues on the case of Turkey on recognition of a particular historical event about 100 years ago. And with Azerbaijan, it's more a territorial conflict. But this is really hampering your own development. And they keep saying, well, we don't know. We have, you know, billionaire Armenian Americans who are giving us money from the U.S. and we don't really need these other countries. But not recognizing that they will never reach their full potential in the same way. And I think India at some point will have to recognize that. If it really wants to compete with China, they will not be able to do so with a constant negative competition happening in this way, whether it's, you know, the CPEC corridor investment.
But Salim, you may say that, I may say that.
Yeah.
But if the average Indian intellectual, I mean, remember, the one thing that I must say, which I have a lot of respect for, Nehru did set up the Indian education sector and the Indian intellectual class. And now India has a very, very deep intellectual class and we have to respect it, right?
Yes.
But yet, that why is it that you have to make this case and the Indian intellectual is not making this case?
No,
that is a puzzle to me. I mean, I would think that the Indian intellectual now, who is waking up, in fact, woken up and is producing a lot of, stuff that the world is appreciating, that Indian intellectual should now be coming up with coherent lines of thinking along the lines that you're saying, that, look, we need to... you know, address our domestic conflicts and our regional conflicts for us to grow. But I don't see that narrative coming out of India. At the same time, as I said, I don't see also the narrative coming out from India or Pakistan, both, for domestic reform. Both countries are reaching out to the world. In fact, as I might also draw your attention to this. My feeling is that Pakistan is so preoccupied with foreign policy that we've forgotten domestic reform. Right, and I think, quite frankly, until both of us prioritize domestic reform, we still have the colonial bureaucracies alive. We still have colonial law alive. We still have colonial structures alive.
Yes.
In the 21st century, we still have structures from 19th century.
Yeah.
Right, and those structures are not capable of thinking modern. How do we get past that?
Well, I mean, I think the efforts that are being made for reform at the provincial level in Pakistan are positive. There has been the recent devolution has led to some innovations in terms of the creation of new, more efficient bureaucracies in Punjab, particularly, and to some degree in KPK as well.
No, I don't agree. Sorry, Salim. Yeah. Just take a look. For example, local government has been denied. Right, the local government has not been accepted. They passed weak local government laws because the Supreme Court forced them to, but they have denied local government. They have created some little thing, but they are not giving it power. Same thing in India, no local government. Right.
Yeah.
Second thing, the colonial bureaucracy in Punjab has been empowered, further empowered, not the reduced power. KPK again, same thing. Both sides rely on the deputy commissioner. Both sides rely on the commissioner. Colonial titles, remember, 19th century.
Yes. No,
and
I know.
They're
I
not mean, willing to move from there.
No,
policymaking still remains 19th century. My point is, unless domestic reform happens, I don't think trade, I mean, I wrote a paper on this once, I don't think trade between India and Pakistan is going to do anything for their economies. Because the domestic structures are going to impede whatever happens.
Mm-hmm.
So well, how do you deal with this? Tell me.
No, I mean, I think in terms of this is a work in progress, and by no means am I saying that we've reached an end. I'm just saying there are some glimmers of hope in terms of, for example, in the IT sector, the ways in which things are moving forward in Punjab. You've got in Karachi recently, you know, the competitiveness reports are suggesting that Karachi is now going to potentially be one of the leading places for investment, and these are, you know, objective nonpartisan reports recently are showing that. I mean, we had the mayor of Karachi at one time was rated the world's best mayor. I mean, we have, of course, you know, there's much room for improvement. But all I'm saying is we cannot let, you know, these colonial bureaucracies lead us to languish in despair. I think there is some potential improvement. In India also, at the same time, you know, there, despite all the other misgivings we may have about Modi, he is trying to improve the investment climate in the country. And that one of the key aspects of that has to be a reduction of the old colonial bureaucracy. So I think there is potential. You're absolutely right. It is going to be a long road ahead, and we have to keep the pressure on them. And these, you know, entitlements that a lot of the old colonial officials have, or the ones who have taken their roles, they need to be held to account.
Yeah, but you see, the point is, Salim, I'll push back a little on this. My feeling is that in Pakistan, in India both, I think, A, we are suffering from 19th century nationalism. Two, we are suffering from 19th century processes and systems, right? Three, we are suffering from very stratified societies, right? Which, although India has a larger veneer of intellectualism than Pakistan, Pakistan has a very thin veneer of intellectualism. India has a much larger veneer. But still, given its size, it's still a veneer, right? The large mass of society is still not involved in that debate. And that's the same thing on both sides. In Pakistan, I think our bigger problem is that we are too worried about foreign policy. India is too worried about being a major player on the international stage, right?
Yes.
Domestic reform on both sides is not prioritized at all. And by that I mean, for example, think about it, very simple, that even our, how do you call it, even property rights systems, legal systems, regulatory systems, they are all sitting in the 19th century. Right, we talk. Both sides pay homage to getting foreign investors in lowering the cost of doing business, etc. But really, the progress is very slow, as can be seen by indicators of competitiveness and otherwise. Yet, when I see the Pakistani intellectuals, especially, not so much Indian, but Indians also, we are more interested in track two diplomacy. We are more interested in foreign policy. My question to you is a very simple one. Why is the Pakistani intellectual, I'm not saying so much Indian, but why is the Pakistani intellectual so invested in foreign policy and not thinking of domestic reform at all?
Well, I mean, I think there's always been this sense in Pakistan that the country is under threat. And so that always makes you feel much more that you have to look outside and look at foreign issues. I think there are, again, some glimmers of hope. For example, the Jinnah Institute, which was started as a think tank by Sheri Rahman and others, it is focused more on domestic issues. So, you know, much of their research and analysis is around domestic issues. So I think you're right. Historically, it hasn't been the case. There is definitely greater momentum. You have, for example, the International Growth Center, which is funded by the UK government, but most of their work is domestically focused on reforms within Pakistan and, you know, empirical work to inform that. So there is, it will take time for sure, And we have to...
Which 70 years, Salim, 70 years. But, I mean, you want us to do another 200 years of tinkering around and waiting for the donors to give us money to do some domestic research?
I think we've had less than a decade of democracy in Pakistan, which has blossomed, better than many expected. I have returned just recently from Tunisia, and many in Tunisia were comparing Pakistan and their own country, which is the only one that survived the Arab Spring with a nascent democracy. They were saying, look, Pakistan, we thought it would go the way of Egypt, and it didn't. So yes, of course, it's terribly inefficient. Yes, there are all kinds of corruption problems. All these issues are there. But the fact that we are willing to wrestle with it, with a country that's, 200 million, twice the size of Egypt, I think it's remarkable still, given all that. So, giving up is not an option. We have to keep at it. I agree with you. Yes, there's...
No, Salim, nobody is giving up. And when you talk in intellectual terms or whatever, we're trying to understand the problem. This is a activist approach that we have in Pakistan, that don't give up and be optimistic. I don't either give up or be optimistic. That's why I'm doing the podcast. I think that places like the podcast, we have to be, or in conferences or things, we have to understand the problem. And my approach is to try and understand the problem. And I appreciate what you're saying. But quite frankly, I am still perplexed by the fact that even though you mentioned two or three places, I don't like to discuss individual places. But quite frankly, when I look at the narrative, for example, there are two big conferences going to take place in December just now. They're the two biggest conferences that take place in Pakistan, on economics at least. And I'm going to be at both of them. I go there, or try and go there, almost every year. Missed it last year. But I'm always amazed at the debate there. I've written about it before as well. That the debate is, the conferences are... we beg donors. I used to arrange one of them. Conferences, we beg the donors to get the money, and they give us some money stringently, and whatever. But they're dissatisfying because we really don't address our problems, right? Mm-hmm. Yes, donors give us money to look at the tax system or to do when randomized controlled trial or this, that, etc. But really, it leaves me cold. Mm. You're an academic, Salim. The problem is we have to also understand our problems the way we see them, not the way that UK sees them, or not the way that Australia sees them, or not the way that somebody, World Bank, sees them. The way I look at it, yes, we follow their lead. They give us a consulting contract. We do this. I've written about it many times. I wrote the history of the economics profession in Pakistan, 1999. Read it. Yes, it's been happening for years. The donors will give us this money and we will do their work. And we call it research. But yet I put to you that we have no research on the colonial legacies of Pakistan. Mm-hmm. We have no research on domestic reform. We have these regressions being run all over the place, or randomized control trials, which, as I said, I did that all my life. But what do we get from those? What do we learn about the fact that there is no entrepreneurship in Pakistan? Right? What do we learn about the fact that there is no industrial competition in Pakistan? What do we learn about the fact that that what is the system of rent seeking in Pakistan? I think those issues we need to understand too for domestic reform to happen. It's all right to tell me in a randomized controlled trial that, if you probably give some farmers some subsidy, they might do something, which we've tried many times over. If you send people to school, give them vouchers, and we've tried that 30 times.
I don't think, I would disagree that there's no entrepreneurship. I think there's enormous entrepreneurship, and the evidence is very clear on that in terms of whether you read, Harvard Business School reports on entrepreneurship. There's a culture of entrepreneurship which is growing. I agree with you on the point of the lack of investment.
Let me give you my evidence on why I say there's no entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. Let's discuss that a little while. Do you see any entrepreneurial firms on the stock exchange? Because I've studied this.
Yes. Yep. Right? No, a lot of them are not going the route of stock exchanges. Okay. Many of them are privately held and for various reasons, for risk management reasons. Okay. But they may well down the road go on. We have had certainly within
We agree on one thing, that there are no entrepreneurial firms on the stock exchange. Very few.
Yes. Sure. No, that's not a rule that Pakistani entrepreneurs
take. That's not a rule. Now, in the privately held firms, the only entrepreneur I can see is Malik Riaz. And I respect him. He's an entrepreneur.
Yes, no, of course. He's a real estate entrepreneur for sure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you have, of course, I mean, you know, if you look at the incubators in Lahore and, you know, there's a whole, there are like 200-300 small firms, whether they are doing IT, whether they're doing, you know, vegetal leather, whether they're doing other kinds of manufacturing enterprises. Those are there. I mean, it, like rice bran oil, I'll give you an example. You know, rice bran is something that people had not thought of in Pakistan as a potential value-added commodity. Once people, there's this one entrepreneur from Karachi, Abid Bhatt, who realized that this was a growing market because people thought rice bran oil is much more healthy than canola and so on. He established the first rice bran oil manufacturing site in Pakistan near Muridke. And interestingly enough, he actually was willing to even get technical help from Indian engineers to set that up. And here's a guy who took a risk. He didn't need to do it. I mean, he had a very successful e-platform business, but he wanted to do that. And so you have time and again several examples of such people. I interact with them through, you know, some of these networks at the World Economic Forum, other places. So, I mean, I don't want to overplay it, but I also don't want to underplay it. So I'm just saying we have a tremendous amount of potential, which is often also not presented as
look, we should do an episode on entrepreneurship too, because I've done some work on this too. Sure, there's statistics, for example.
Yeah.
Yes, of course, there is going to be, you know, 5%. But if you look at the whole distribution, we'll be a little surprised. But let's leave that aside for a moment.
Yeah.
The question that really I want to address is that, yes, India-Pakistan peace is important. Yes, regional peace is important, etc. And the issue is that, unfortunately, there's no constituency on both sides. Your point is well taken that there should be mediation, but I see very little potential for mediation because, unfortunately, I think Pakistan might even be ready for mediation, but I don't think India will be ready for mediation anytime soon. But yeah. I think that's given, agreed, totally not disagreed at all on this. Yes, mediation should happen. I hope India accepts it, but let's leave that aside. The question that I really am perplexed by is that, A, there is no desire on the part of the intellectual community, apart from going to track two dialogues. Pakistani community, intellectual community is yelling for peace all the time, but the Indian community is not really coming out a lot for it. So I think that's the way I look at it. But the more important thing that I feel is that I think on both sides, I don't know why there is no desire for domestic reform, and everybody thinks that only doing international stuff will get us there. That's my view.
So anyway, yeah, no, tell me why. I am not disagreeing. I'm just saying that it's just a matter of magnitude of, fair significance enough. For different factors. Mm-hmm. And in terms of, changing the Indian perception, I think that's where the role of the media is going to be very important. I mean, we've seen it in the U.S. election, what a negative role the media can play. Mm-hmm. There is a very positive role that could be played if the Indian media changed its approach. For example, there was the Aman Ki Asha campaign, which was run for some time. There are people like Barkha Dutt in the Indian media who are willing to engage on positive issues on Pakistan. I think we need to make it clear that, you know, this is an area where Pakistani intellectuals can help even the very small minority of Indian intellectuals or journalists who want to project that.
I think they are trying to do that. The tragedy is, unfortunately, on both sides. I won't blame them. The media is... Media, look, after Trump's thing and after what we are seeing in the American media, I think the whole world is rethinking media and trying to understand what's happening. And I don't think we understand at all, because social media and all the instant media, all this stuff is media stars. I don't know where it's going, and I have no idea. I read about it a little, not a lot. But I think same thing happened in India. For example, when Om Puri came out for Pakistani actors, you saw the reaction that happened. I mean, I think the poor guy, a man of his stature, was so... the program that I saw was really... devastating.
Yeah, no, it's really vitriolic. Yeah,
the same thing that I saw was, they create Aman Ki Asha, for example, again was created by international money. UK aid created it, right?
Yeah.
But the other thing, when they created those programs, the India Pakistan program, I've seen some of them, I'm sure you have too. Mm-hmm. Both sides engage in such yelling matches, you can't hear anything at all. both sides get so vitriolic, it's amazing, right? So I don't know.
But that's why, you know, that goes back to my earlier point that we need to invest in at least some tangible peace building on these, what I think are the two easiest conflicts to resolve. Once people see that, look, you know, we can actually resolve them. And that, yes, look, if Siachen, there is a peace park effort, both countries can benefit from having mountaineers go to those areas which are inaccessible. You know, so I think it's a kind of a dialectic, you know, it's a chicken and the egg problem, which comes first. And if we can break that cycle, I believe there is potential.
Fair enough. Okay, Salim, thank you
very
much.
I use the example of, you know, who could have thought between Egypt and Israel, Jordan and Israel. I mean, so many countries, you know, Japan and the U.S., you know, we dropped two nuclear bombs on Japan and we were able to make peace with them within a matter of a few decades. It's possible. It requires leadership. Yeah. It requires a change of perception.
But please don't go to those examples. There are
many
implications there.
Yes. No. I hope we never have to go that route. But I'm just saying that peace is possible, certainly, in even the most.
No, of course it is. And we have to believe it. And I agree with you. Look, I agree with you. Eventually, there's no way out. Peace will have to happen. Will be done. Unfortunately, I don't see it coming anytime soon. It's going to take a long time. And we have to. Meanwhile, think of other things to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, we have to keep on with other efforts, certainly. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Salim. Thank you. All the best.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai.
Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.